to do in the coming 60 minutes is I tell a bit about the simulation work that we're doing in MINDS, coarse grain membrane simulations. It will be a little bit of a motivation of a way to approach these things. So I will explain the model that we use, show the properties of this model, and then I will illustrate by some rather eclectic examples of what you might do with these models, what kind of problems you can ask, or things that we have done, things that we have not done. Let's see how far we go with that. Well, so every good talk and also every bad talk starts with an introduction and a motivation, so I just give you my short version of that. Promise not to hold you up too long. Why are we all here? Cells. We all have learned so far that membranes, which is the topic of this workshop, are very important for cells. They surround cells, they're everywhere inside cells. But the workshop is called Cells and Materials. And well, after the morning session, it's no longer, I don't really need to say about what why membranes are also interesting materials. David has done a good job on that. But maybe it's still somewhat mysterious for biologists why I would be interested in the material properties of membranes. And in fact, I would like to argue that even if you're not a biologist, you should be very much concerned with the material properties of membranes, because those are really extraordinarily nice materials to work with. So give me my 5 pence of mechanical thinking. I do it as a physicist. So let's think about a membrane. A membrane is a very thin extended sheet. Thin means it's 5 nanometers, 2 molecules, extremely thin sheet. And what is it composed of in its interior? It's basically dense hydrocarbons. Dense hydrocarbons. Typical length scales everywhere is 5 nanometers. And coming from an institute like the one I come from, Max Planck Institute for Polymer Research, you immediately start to think about things like polymer melts, if you see these specifications. And then you start to think that whatever elastic property this thing has, the Young model is probably going to be somewhere between rubber and plastic. Let's just agree upon friends 10 to the 7 Pascal or something like this. And let's not fight about orders of magnitude here. Well, but you also know that the bulk modulus is probably not the nicest modulus to characterize something as thin and extended as a membrane. In fact, you would like to know bending things. I need to open books like this, for instance, Theory of Elasticity, and that tells you that the really interesting quantity of the bending modulus, which is the energy per unit area to achieve some radius of curvature, somehow depends on things like the Young modulus. It goes linear with the Young modulus. You use stiffer materials, that gives you stiffer membranes. And it goes like thickness cubed in certain limiting approximations, which also makes sense if you think, let's say, of paper and cardboard. Cardboard is thicker, so it's harder to bend. Well, the interesting thing about this formula is, let's just plug in the numbers that I just picked out of thin air. You get the bending modulus of 25 kT. And the nice thing is that's basically about right. Now, since I was a bit sloppy in estimating this number, there's not too much relevance to this estimate. It's just nice that scaling theory once more at least gets you the order of magnitude right. There's one more point I want to make here, and that is that there's something rather interesting about a few tens of kT as a number. And the first thing is that this is bigger than thermal energy. I've heard various times here, well, the bending modulus of membranes is of the order of thermal energy. That's the first approximation right, but it's important and it's bigger than thermal energy. Why? Because it's bigger, so the bilayer doesn't fluctuate into pieces. I mean, membranes are stable. Nature entrusts the life of every living cell on this planet to this bilayer, so it better not fluctuate into pieces. On the other hand, it's not exorbitantly bigger than thermal energy. It's not 1,000 kT or so, which means that, let's say, nanoscopic sources of energy, such as molecular motors, or for that matter, the energy released in these kinds of cell assembly processes, are actually able to deform that membrane. In other words, these substances just have the right material properties to be stable, but to be deformable on the scale that they're interesting. So these are ideal materials for nanotechnology. Now the weird thing about this, if you think about nanotechnology, if you open any weird book on nanotechnology, you think, well, nanotechnology is made of this shiny metal stuff. In order to prove this, just look at a few pictures that you find typically. These things like this is, I don't know quite what this is, brutally attacking this red blood cell here. And you see that. I'm not quite sure. Maybe this is one of these things from Michael Crichton's books, what was this called? Praise. You evidently see that the red blood cell is apparently a soft thing. It's been indented here viciously. This thing is like, I don't know, it looks rather sturdy to me. This thing appears, I'm guessing here, appears to be something like an artificial nerve cell. It has these connectors and so. And so there are flashes going on here, which means this person really needs to rethink his notion of electrostatics in aqueous environments. And this thing is apparently some sort of molecular assembly run. What strikes me most is here that you can see the atoms here, but you can't see them here. But the fact that this seems to be shiny means this is probably going to be metal. And I'm trying to argue that this is probably not metal. Why? I just have to turn the argument around that I just gave you. So this was the equation, we now all know. Let's put in 25 kT here, because I argued that this is the right number to do anything useful with these materials. But then let's put in a Young modulus of 10 to the 10 Pascal, metal. Right? Then you find that the thickness of this thing is 0.5 nanometers, 5 angstroms. And the metal layer of that thickness is going to fall apart. Okay. So it might have the correct bending stability, but it's not going to be useful to build anything on it, because it's going to fall apart. And that just basically means that nanotechnology invariably means you have to use soft matter. And I didn't come to this conclusion. I mean, 5 billion years ago, nature came to this conclusion, because nature basically is nanotechnology surrounding us and working all the time everywhere, membranes everywhere, okay? So this is probably a message to the nanosciences and not to us. We all know that. The thing as a physicist that interests me about these things is that the membrane is such a rich physical problem to think about in the first place. It shows physics on all kinds of different lengths and timescales. On the smallest scale, we have self-assembly going on. We have it self-assembles to a fluid bilayer, well, to many structures. The one that we're interested in is the fluidity of this thing. It can embed proteins in here. Across the membrane, it might have rather non-trivial tangential pressure profiles, which again have something to do on larger length scale with things like bending deformation. So there's a lot of stuff going on here that you can study. But since there is so much stuff going on, again, on so many different length scales, what that means is that when you study the system, the approach that you should take should somehow be tuned towards the length scale that you're currently interested in. And that's even too special of a statement. It holds true for any system. Any system you study, you better make sure that you treat it according to the questions that you're asking. For theory, that was always true. I mean, if you make a theory of gravitation, you don't have to know about the quark structure of matter. I mean, that's why Newton can come up with a theory of gravitation if you think about it for a bit longer. If Newton had to know the state of matter because that matters for gravity, he would never come up because he didn't really know about atoms. So for theory, this is clear. For simulation, it's equally true, but for some reason, it always turns out that if a simulationist models something that doesn't immediately look like the real system, he's going to be bashed by anyone saying, well, I can't see the atoms or anything like this. Well, experimentalists also do this all the time. I mean, if you want to know something like the dielectric response of a material, you don't do rheology. Or if you want to know the G of R, you do a scattering experiment. You don't measure the heat capacity. So you just got to do the right thing for the right question. And that's what we're going to do today. So we're going to do simulation. And simulation membrane, that's not a unique thing. I mean, there's an awful lot of stuff going on. Roughly, you can order the simulation of membranes on a scale that just expands from very highly detailed simulations up to very coarse-grained, it's called coarse-grained simulations. On this level here, you pay attention to every single detail, every single atom. You love each hydrogen atom personally. And then you start, well, maybe not always I have to know everything. I can coarse-grain away certain hydrogen atoms, go to united atom models. And I say, well, maybe the coline group that I have up here is basically one charged residue or something like this, and the phosphate also. And I start to combine these things, and then it starts to look a bit more like a sketch or a cartoon. And once I've started doing that, there's nothing to stop me to go any further. It becomes simpler and simpler and simpler, up to the point where on this side, I only have things like triangulated surfaces, or helper hematolins for that matter. And that's not just laziness, right? And it's not just that we cannot simulate these things on the length and time scale that we're interested in. It's also that a lot of the physics happening on this level has absolutely nothing to do with the fact that there's a specific nitrogen atom dangling around somewhere. A lot of stuff coarse grains away, and the idea that membranes can be characterized by things like a single bending modulus or expansivity modulus means that a lot of information that is very necessary here gets lost coarse graining. It doesn't play any role anymore. Physics always scales. I'm going to work in this intermediate regime, which is called bead spring model, because they're just beads connected by a few springs that make a caricature of a lipid. it roughly divides into sort of standard models where you have Lennard-Jones spheres and certain potentials, into things which are called DPD simulation, that stands for dissipative particle dynamics. It's different potentials, different thermostats. It's also coarse grain technique, and very recently solvent-free models. I would say that this also represents increasing numerical efficiency, but that's a matter of debate. It depends on who you talk to. If you talk to people who do the work here, and compare this to people who do the work here, they of course disagree about who's faster. I'm gonna work on this part. But before I talk about solvent-free membranes, I should maybe say a few words of why this would be something that anyone would anyway want to do. Why is solvent-free good? Maybe I should first say about when solvent-free is bad. If you're interested in specific aspects of the solvent, particularly on an atomistic scale, we all agreed that water was very... I gave a talk explaining why water is important. We all know water is important. If you do dynamics, water is important enough. There are many instances where water is important. We should never ever throw it away. But there are instances where it's not important and that it's tedious to have it. Why? Well, a membrane to first order is basically a surface, while the solvent around the membrane is the bulk. In other words, that means that the relation between the membrane and the solvent is the same as between surface and bulk in thermodynamics. And if we all have learned our thermodynamics well, that just means that if we do it in an unclever way, studying membranes may become the study of a finite size effect. And that's not really what we want to do if we spend so many dollars on computers to get our simulations going. So we would like to study this thing and not that thing, not the solvent. As an illustrative example of this, this is a paper that came out 2 years ago by Mohamed Larachi and Sunil Kumar. They looked at mixed vesicles of two different species of lipids and asked themselves, how do these patches of A and B lipids slowly coarse grain? In their simulations, they had 16,000 coarse grain DPD lipids, 4 beads per lipid, which means about 64,000 degrees of freedom for their lipids. But all in all, they had about 1.5 million particles in the box, because the rest was solvent. So about 96% of the simulation time was spent with the solvent. And they had some sort of good justification for doing that because they were indeed interested in certain aspects of the kinetics and the dynamics where the solvent plays a role. But if they were not interested in these aspects, then getting 4% benefit out of your simulation does not seem to be a smart way of doing it. So we better try to find something else. Unfortunately, it turns out that this is rather difficult. Or maybe we pose the question the other way around. Solvent-free is something that is used for decades in polymer simulations. For some reason, it has not picked up in the membrane community until rather recently. Well, why is that so? The key thing to remember is that polymers don't have to self-assemble. Membranes have to self-assemble, which means, let's say we throw away the solvent, we need to replace it by some sort of effective cohesive interaction between the molecules. And this cohesive interaction, which binds these things together in order to drive the self-assembly process, has to be of order KT. It's not of order electron volts, which is what holds polymers together, which means the very same forces which bind membranes together, which hold them, are the forces which threaten their existence by thermally ripping them into pieces. So having a membrane as a stable object is a very delicate balance between these things, and you first have to get that balance right before you can start anything else. So this is a problem we need to solve that the polymer people never need to think about. And it turned out that under these conditions, getting a fluid membrane, a self-assembled fluid membrane, was the key challenge, the major difficulty. Why? Well, why? People basically thought, okay, there's this sort of cohesive energy, we need to drive some sort of aggregation. They said, well, if we have some weak, there are two obvious limits. Have your weak attraction, nothing's going to happen. These things remain flying around in the gas phase. If you have a strong attraction, this you're certainly going to aggregate to something like a solid bilayer. It's going to aggregate, it's going to be a rigid board. And if you're only carefully somewhere in between, you're going to get a fluid. Unfortunately, it turned out there's no fluid phase in between. And that's what people got very annoyed by this. Before you go ahead and memorize this, this is wrong. It's an incorrect conclusion. And I will later explain where it comes from. But for the time being, people have then thought, well, if it doesn't work, the idea of having these attractive pair forces probably is not so good. Maybe pair forces is not a good idea to start with. So previous and current solutions of this problem, most of them involve ways of getting overcoming the idea of pair forces. So these are papers that have been published to solve this problem. The oldest one is this first one by Drofemex and Leibler from 1991. They did not use pair forces, they used some sort of multi-body potentials, and in fact it did work. They self-assembled vesicles out of this and measured the bending modulus. But there was never any follow-up on this thing, at least for an entire decade. If you go on conferences and just between, just off the record, some people tell you that there was a problem in this thing. I don't know what the problem was. The basic idea has been reused about 10 years later by Noguchi and Takasu, and they have put this into a somewhat different model, same idea of multi-body potentials, and that worked nicely. So they get self-assembled membranes. The same thing has been done by Bauer and Frenkel, and lately by Noguchi and Kornberg in a different context. A different solution has been proposed by Aitin and Voss, who have basically taken the membrane and tethering the lipids together in this thing, which is something I don't particularly like, because once you tether the membrane, it's not a fluid membrane anymore. And things like the changes of topology or just anything that changes the Gaussian curvature is going to be difficult here. They have done more work on this, and Gary Aitin is actually in this conference. Is he here already? Hello? No. So he's going to give a talk on Wednesday morning about these things. Odette Farago has proposed a different solution. He did use pair potentials, but he used about six different ones having 12 different tuning parameters, and we also managed to get a fluid bilayer phase.
How do you know when you have a fluid? How do you determine when you have a fluid bilayer?
Well, if the lipids can move past each other, it's a fluid. If the lipids always keep the same nature, it's a solid. So he had about 12 different tuning parameters and managed to get a fluid membrane. There were some self-assembly problems here. The other problem is if I have to retune 12 parameters in order to change the structure, that is a bit tedious. There was a model by Grace Brannigan and Frank Brown who used spherocylinders and added angular-dependent interactions. The angular-dependent interactions means that in this way you have a second tweak. You can kind of distribute the adhesive energy between these two terms and thereby keep it fluid. Frank is here. Are you going to talk about this one, or are you going to talk about the second one? Right. And the last two models, one is developed by us, the other one is also by Brannigan, Phillips, and Brown. Those are now two models that exclusively use pair potentials. There's no multi-body stuff going on. Actually, also not very much parameter tuning. And for what I'm concerned, those are the only ones that I currently will be using. But I mean, there are other people that would disagree. So let's just label that quickly again. We have multi-body interactions, tethered membranes, highly tuned Lennard-Jones membrane, angle-dependent potentials, and pair potentials. And I'll be talking about this thing. Since Frank will be talking about this, I take the liberty to talk about our one. So may I introduce, this is our lipid. It has one head that will be termed hydrophilic and tails that are hydrophobic. And the first question one might ask, my goodness, only three beads. That doesn't really look like a lipid, maybe even the aspect ratio and everything. Actually, if you put it side by side, this aspect ratio is not too bad. If you think about the aspect ratios, half a bilayer thickness divided by the square of the area per molecule, that roughly gets you to the number of three. So that's actually not so bad. So what else
the
do you
order mean? Parameter goes with that too, right? The order parameter goes with this, in that you have probably
you make it longer, the order parameter.
Well, the comparative regions of the membrane are a lot stiffer, not moving as much, you know. That's good physically for me.
The order parameter will also depend on the rest of the interactions we put in, and it doesn't be measured. So what you need to link these things together in order to get one molecule. We stiffened them a little bit so that they're not completely floppy, so they're sort of a spring that keeps that roughly straight. And the key thing is, well, we need to make some interactions between sections of these lipids. And for that, we only have the following two choices. The head beads repel, and the tail beads, apart from repelling at close distance, attract at a long distance. There's some generic potential that looks like that, and there are two parameters in there, and both are going to be tuned. It's the depth of potential, which in some sense is how deep is this compared to thermal energy, and how long range is it. That's the only thing we're going to play around with. Okay, there's one more parameter. We can play with the size of the head. Okay.
So just there's no interaction. What's the interaction between the blue and the yellow then?
They repel.
Oh, they repel.
So one brief word of how we do simulations. We do molecular dynamic simulations, but we could just as well do Monte Carlo, which is do MD, which means we integrate Langevin's equation of motion, mass times acceleration is minus the gradient of all the conservative forces, plus some friction and noise, which are adjusted in order to satisfy fluctuation dissipation theorem, such that this corresponds to a canonical ensemble. You can, if you want to do this in a pairwise fashion, in which case it equilibrates faster. D keeping the thermostat.
Can you clarify the notation a little bit? R sub I is
also
the vector position.
R sub I is the position of the ith bead in our simulation box. That's its mass. This is
R, is a vector. R sub I is a vector.
Is a vector, right. This is minus the gradient with the spectral coordinate I of my entire potential energy, thinking that I have to sum of all the things that I have in my system, minus a friction which goes negative, the opposite direction is the velocity of that particle, and it has a noise term. And so the strength of noise and friction have to be adjusted according to fluctuation dissipation so that this corresponds to a canonical ensemble.
So that's really three-end differential equations.
Right. Yeah, this is actually, yeah. And differential equation. That's why you do it on a computer and not on paper.
We're going to miss this, but why did you choose three beads?
Oh,
what, why
we just had the impression one bead is a bit not too long. Well, actually, Trofimex and I took one bead, but then they had to put a dipole on this bead saying, okay, there's an up and there's a down. So two is like the minimum that seems plausible for using point interactions. And I thought since somehow the tail should be longer than the head, two beads for the tail and one for the head. We also played around with four, changes things quantitatively but not qualitatively much. And if you make it much longer than that, then this aspect ratio thingy does not become very good anymore. It seems like one real lipid would then be simulated by like two or three coarse grained lipids, which is not what you want to do the other way you want.
So in the bead model, the R sub I corresponds to the position of one of the three beads?
One of the three beads.
So there's really six entities.
Okay, if you want to do the counting like this.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just trying to see how many differential equations.
A lot. I mean, we have 16.
Yeah,
we have thousands and thousands of degrees of freedom in there, and there are three differential equations for each and every one of them.
Okay.
But that's I mean, every one doing molecular dynamics is always the same thing.
Okay.
The point is, it's easy equations. You can solve them easily. They're not, because of these terms, everything is very stable, unless you take two big time steps.
So is this white term random or is it going to be?
That's Gaussian noise.
Okay.
White noise.
And so why are you introducing this noise term?
I'm introducing this, if I leave these two terms out, right, then I'm integrating Newton's equation of motions, which means I'm in an ensemble in which energy is conserved. That's not the correct ensemble to work in if you're at constant temperature. At constant temperature, energy fluctuates. So there are random. So there's a bead out there. There's random kicks from the environment that kick it, that heat it up. But I can't just heat it up because then it would just heat to infinity. The same forces that cause random kicks also slow down something. If it moves and it bumps against other things, and it gets slowed down again. So the thermal heat bath environment provides random kicks and it provides a friction. And since this comes from the same thing, the thermal heat bath, there must be a relation between these two things, which is the fluctuation dissipation theorem that tells you if you do this correctly, you end up at a canonical ensemble. So the energy fluctuates appropriately, the variance is proportional to temperature and heat capacity and borderline all these things. Any more questions on molecular? I realize, is this the first talk on molecular dynamics simulation in this entire? Maybe I should have spent more time on. Anyway, so we can do this at constant volume or constant pressure, constant area, constant tension, as we wish. The software we use to do this is a package we call Espresso. It has been developed at the Max Planck Institute over the past couple of years. It's basically a C core engine that is parallelized and everything. It's controlled by a script language, TCL, which explains what's the precise system you would like to simulate, for how long, and what is it you want to evaluate. This thing is open source. It can be downloaded here. All the membrane things are already in there. You can play around with it. Well, and if we take our lipids and throw them together, we get this kind of self-assembly. What I've shown here is actually we take lipids with a varying head group, so very small heads here, very big heads here. If the lipids have very big heads, they assemble to spherical micelles. If you make the head smaller, they assemble to cylindrical micelles, which can be unbranched or branched. If you make the head even smaller, they will assemble to membranes. If you make them even smaller, at some point the head's going to be unimportant and everything collapses to one blob, just as oil would do.
What are the parameters in this?
The parameters? For this particular case, I can tell you. I haven't even said about attractions and stuff like this. I will specify this later. There are certain range, depth of the attraction is basically KT.
Okay.
The range is like 1 or 2 meter diameters.
What do you do to set up the inverse micelles in the A
attempt to inverse Mies-Fells with a system in which we course correct a way to solve it. That doesn't work. It's not an inverse Mies-Fells. This is a block.
So the basic effect of the size of the head basically gives a range parameter on the potential interaction.
No, not really. The range parameter, the range of attraction is held constant here. The main thing, this is a kind of excluded volume kind of thing. It fixes like there's
so
a key parameter.
The range relative to the sort of
yeah, there's a key parameter here, which is a packing parameter, which is the product of area and length divided by the volume of this thing, which is introduced like 20 years ago or so, or longer, by Isulashvili. You can actually quantitatively map that here. If you fix it at one point, everything else falls in place. That works.
And it's the standard potential 1/r potential?
Nope.
Oh, okay.
No, nope, something completely different.
Okay.
And it's important.
Green tops.
Yeah.
So is that a Jones type potential?
Nope. That's the hydrophilic part, that's the hydrophobic part.
But
so these are.
One is a bit pale in your.
Pale.
Deeper in the plane.
That's because it's. That's one way to illustrate that this is at the back.
It's fog.
There's some switch you can turn on in VMD that, I don't know, Fogify or whatever this is called. It helps depth perception. That's all it is. All right, so.
Could I just ask if the, you know, that old area length volume thing from Jacob Israelashvili,
yeah,
did it hold here too?
Yes.
You know, like the 0.33 is the Mies cells.
You can take the head group,
yeah,
and then scale the packing parameter to the size of the head group. And then since the other ones you don't really know, you have to fix it at some point, but you fix this transition at 1/3, it turns out that this transition happens at a half.
Yeah.
As it should.
Yeah, so your choice of, whether it's right or wrong, the choice of 2 versus 1, you know, the...
We haven't done this for 4, so I don't know,
yeah,
whether it would work there,
yeah,
as well. For this thing, it works.
Yeah.
My goodness, I'm not doing well in time. So let me just show you one example of such a self-assembly thing. So this is a gas of lipids. And there's my mouse. And we're going to just start this off and see what happens when they aggregate. So very quickly you see these aggregates forming, wobbling around. They look like pancakes and they grow. There's a particular big one, and this pancake will now close up.
Do you have periodic gravity connection?
Yeah, to make a little vesicle. There's another vesicle here, there's another pancake here. That's too small, it kind of close up. But this one can, for instance, meet this one, and now it's going to be sucked up, so that's a bigger one. This actually is a cut vesicle of a periodic boundary condition, because it's a bit ugly that it's cut up, but you can now look inside here and see that it's really hollow in the inside. And you see these free lipids floating around here, so we do actually have a chemical potential between lipids and the bulk, and so they exchange, even though at a too high fraction of lipids in the bulk. So, phase diagrams. We know that these things assemble. Now let's specify a little bit better under which conditions they do assemble what. I told you we have two parameters in the system. One is the range of the attraction, which is plotted here on the horizontal axis. The other one is the depth, or the inverse depth, which is basically temperature. So what we did is we took our system, put it as a flat bilayer. We constructed the bilayer because we know already we can sample, which I showed you. Put it in a flat bilayer under conditions of zero tension, and then see what happens for each of these points in here. If it's too hot, the thing falls apart. It's unstable, it evaporates. If it's too cold, it gets into the gel phase. So in these membranes, the diffusion constant is about 2 orders of magnitude lower than what we would measure in between here, which is the fluid phase. So we do get gas, fluid, gel, but only if the range of adhesion is long enough. Actually, see if the adhesion range is too short, there's a direct transition from not a bilayer to a gel phase. And that's what people have constantly seen in their simulations. And so, well, there's no way to do this with a PEP potential. Actually, the reason is because they always use the Lennard-Jones potential, and some way of showing that this is bad is, so this is the Lennard-Jones potential, this one. Now let's just chop it down in the middle and put a flat bit in between, just artificially make it longer. And we plot this horizontal bit in here. And then we do the entire thing again, unstable, fluid, gel, and the fluid phase basically vanishes exactly at the point where the Lennard-Jones potential is. So it doesn't work with Lennard-Jones because Lennard-Jones is just little bit too short range. Now you might argue about everything other than Lennard-Jones is not physical because Lennard-Jones is one of our 6 and dispersion and da da da. all these potentials are very coarse-grained effective potentials. There's no one telling you what they should actually look like. So the potential we are using are in no way more physical or less physical than this thing. So basically, you have to make it work, and then later on, you try to do some systematic coarse-grained if you want. So there's nothing unphysical about these potentials. So we have fluid phases, which is good, which took us a long time to go. Let's now study their properties. One of the most important properties of these fluid membranes is their bending modulus, and the way we get it is in the following way. Well, we have this Helfrich Hamiltonian that we heard about today and a few days ago as well, which in linearized mesh is basically a Laplacian squared plus a gradient squared for the tension. Since this is a quadratic theorem in H, we can fully decompose and do all the stats mech with it. And it tells us that in the Fourier modes, the mean squared amplitude of each Fourier mode is proportional to kT, because it's a thermal fluctuation, and inversely proportional to things which involve the mode but also the moduli. So if you do this at zero tension, this term drops out, and what you get is kT over L squared kappa q to the minus 4. You can fit to this regime.
How do you set the tension to zero?
We put the bilayer in a box and we permit the size of the box to adjust until we're at the point where the stress tensor vanishes.
Oh.
Then we do some dynamic coupling so it can actually fluctuate as it should at constant tension. The size should fluctuate a little bit, and it does. It's called Anderson boundary condition, and we do this in some variation. So we fit to this behavior, we get the prefactor, where we know everything except for kappa, and that's how we get the bending modulus. This is a typical plot, that's wave factor, that's the mean squared amplitude. In a log-log plot, that should be a slope of minus 4, and that's what it actually is in the limit of low Qs, which is large length scales. Get the prefactors. Here we have the typical values for the tension that you get for various ranges. And you see that the ranges for kappa fall anywhere between 3 and 30 kT, which is very good because that's basically the range you want to be in for phospholipids. So that works out. However, there's one problem I would like to mention. Doing it like this means we're only probing very, very weak bending in our system. Now why is that so? Think of any particular given Fourier mode, HQE to the IQX. The curvature of this is, now I'm forgetting things like prefactors. The curvature of this is the second derivative, which is HQ Q squared. Means the curve to be average curvature squared, it's the modulus squared of this, which is q to the 4 hq modulus squared, and this I just worked out what that is. It was like kt over l squared and times a q to the minus 4, the q to the minus 4 is going to kill that, and you get kt over l squared kappa, which means that the average radius of curvature that you're going to excite is 1 over the root mean squared of this, kappa over kt times l, which is 3, since kappa is of the order of 10, 20, which means 3 or 5 times the size of your box. Those are very, very large radii of curvature, which means this is very, very low bending. This is much weaker bending than anything we actually would like to do in these simulations when we form these small vesicles and so on. So we would like to know how good is that, or when we do real bad bending to our membranes, bending that exceeds thermal energies in order to be excited. Well, one alternative is rather than to measure what it does among fluctuations is to impose actually a deformation and measure how much force we need to do that. That was done first by Wotted and Otter and Wim-Riels a few years ago. They basically fixed an undulation mode of the bilayer, and they made the amplitude much bigger than thermal energy, and measured the force that it took to hold it like that. But you can imagine that holding an entire bending mode is not such a simple animal to constrain. So this is actually a technically rather sophisticated thing. And we figured there's sort of an infinitely simpler way of doing that, which is just looking how experimenters do that. We just pull a membrane tether. So we take a cylindrical membrane and put it in our simulation box, and via periodic boundary conditions, this is a long tether. Now just imagine you stretch that box, the same number of lipids in there. The membrane tether is going to be longer, but it has to shrink in radius, of course, because there's a finite number of lipids available there. Which means from here to here to here, the curvature energy will go up because the range of curvature goes down, which means we have to put in energy into the system to do that. And that means at any given point here, there's a force that wants to pull us back to reduce the range of curvature. In other words, the energy of such a thing is just 1/2 times the bending modulus times the curvature squared times the area, 2 pi RL. And the force is just the derivative of this with respect to L at constant area, which just turns out to be 2 pi kappa over r. Solving this for kappa is easy. The bending modulus is the force which you need to hold the tether multiplied by the radius divided by 2 pi. Rather simple. And that's a simple simulation to do. Now you might worry, oh, this is all a ground state argument, we have not mentioned what the fluctuations do, these things wobble, as you see. Well, what happens if you have fluctuations? The force goes up. Just as it's pulling a polymer costs a force because you're sort of killing the fluctuations, the force here due to fluctuations would be higher than the simple ground state argument force. However, in order for this membrane to wobble around, since there's only that much given area available, the mean radius has to contract in order to free area which you can flop around, which means that the radius will go down. Force goes up, radius goes down, and in the simplest possible theory that a little plane wave approximation for this thing integrating at the modes, it turns out those two effects exactly cancel. So it's force times radius, force you actually measure times the radius you actually measure, divided by 2 pi, and that's your bending moment. Now we can do this, of course, with radii much, much smaller than 4 times box size. If you do this, we've done this here in one example, this is plotted the width of our membrane divided by the radius of curvature which we're imposing, and that's kappa, measured as f times r over 2 pi. That's basically the numbers you get from these tether pulling. For the same membrane, if we do the fluctuation analysis, this is what we get. We're very, very happy that we actually do get the same numbers here. But really the amazing thing is, if you look at the amount of bending here, W over R equal to 1 would mean we're bending in the same length scale as the thickness of the membrane. And shortly before that, we don't even seem to be noticing that we're doing something really, really bad to our system. The accuracy is not as good as we would like to have it. We're currently working on making these errors smaller. But it seems to, within the accuracy that we can measure it, higher order effects like quartics in the curvatures are not showing up, which is very, very encouraging. All these simple, healthy theories do work to enormous amounts of bending. It's quite encouraging. When did I start? Well, so let's now look at a few eclectic examples of stuff you might do. One thing is domain-induced budding. What is that? Let's look at a membrane which is a mixture of two different lipids. Just call them A and B instead of phosphatidylcholine and DPP and so on. A and B. A and B don't like each other, so A and B go out of each other's way. So they phase separate into an A and a B phase, and these phases grow over the course and so on. But then you have these big patches, and what happens is some point is that these big patches suddenly bulge out to form these vesicles. The reason why they do that is because at some point paying the bending price for the curvature is lower than all this line tension accumulating, because as Gemma mentioned, bending energy is scale invariant. This costs you 8 pi kappa independent of how big the patches. This costs you 2 pi r times the line tension which grows as the patch grows. So there are nice experiments been done a few years ago by in the group of Webb. They have nicely marked the two different lipids with two different dyes, and you see that there are actually these nice things forming. And by close monitoring of what this edge actually looks like, you can infer things like what the line tension is and so on. For what we are concerned with, as I said, the simple argument to get something like this is the line change is 2 pi r times the 2 pi r patch times the line tension, the curvature energy is 8 pi kappa. Balancing then tells you that the butt size at the point where this happens is twice the bending modulus divided by gamma. And if you say the bending modulus, well, the 25 kT we had before, and a line change maybe a kT per nanometer, this we can argue, but this gets you to about 50 nanometers. But that's exactly the size in which the simulations, these coarse grain simulations, are good. They're too big for atomistic simulations. It may or may not be too small for continuum theory, but this is a scale that can be might just as well probe. Show you just an example here. This is a simulation we did. This is a vesicle also containing 16,000 lipids. Half of them are A, half of them are B. They're basically completely identical in their intra actions, but their interactions are such that yellow and blue don't like each other as much. So if I now go ahead and start the movie, so this thing was equilibrated with telling them they're all alike. At some point we switch on, by the way, yellow, blue, you don't like each other. And then these things start to phase separate, initially via some sort of spinodal decomposition. But at some point, the patches reach such a size that the line energy becomes strong enough to squeeze butts off, and that's exactly what happens then. So we see spinodal decomposition, and at some point, these things just start to blob out, and this will also terminate at some point. We just stop the simulation, because it was obvious what's going to happen. If there was solvent in there, which we don't, there would be another volume constraint and the story would be different. The question of excess area and all these things.
So in that blue sphere, that means that there's yellows on the inside?
No.
Mm-hmm. So these are actually separate.
They're completely phase separate. This blue vesicle now only contains blue lipids.
Oh.
The yellow ones only contains your blood. Actually, see, there's a little blue guy that you just got stuck in here.
Sure. There is no inside.
Well, there's hollow inside. It's they're bags, empty bags. It's not like a micelle, but everything extends to the inside.
But have you scratched your previous 3D model then?
Have I what?
Are you still 3D?
Yes.
Models?
Yes, you can see here.
Another additional interaction.
And then I'm confused. So what's the difference?
The difference is there's some, we're playing with a range of interaction. There's some range of interaction between the yellow guys and between yellow and yellow and between blue and blue. We make that just the same. But between yellow and blue,
oh,
make the interaction a little bit shorter in order to model the Chi parameter effect.
So the yellow and the blue are the heads, and then there's this sort of
orange.
Yeah, the orange stuff is the tails. The tails are. Okay, so the difference in the interaction actually happens in the tails. But the tails interact differently. We just label the heads because that's what you see all the time. So just visually.
Did you preserve any tethers in this?
Tethers?
They come down, but they would still be tethered if they were a vesicle. Like daughter vesicles.
Oh, yeah. Well, they typically fuse spontaneously.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
My belief is that the propensity of fusion in these very simple systems, we have very easy flip-flop, is too large compared to what a real lipid would do.
Yeah.
The flip-flop rates are much too high compared to...
No, but cells do spit out.
Yeah, they do spit
vesicle.
Out, but typically you need proteins to do that and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And on that level, I'm not feeling all too comfortable. Studying fusion is something that is a teeny bit more specific and local than something like that. I mean, people have studied fusion on this level, and I'm not. Sometimes they see something they like, and something they publish it, and sometimes they see something they don't like, and they don't publish it. Overall, I'm a bit skeptical whether it's a good idea to do fusion on that scale.
Mm-hmm.
Well, can do the same thing the other way around. Here we have this pancake patch argument, so our membrane grows up to a side and then buckles. Actually, it can do even that if there's no membrane around. That's what I showed you in the simulation, just pancake growing up to a size, and then they're big enough and then they form a patch. You can do this by taking such vesicle solution, you ultrasonicate them, which means you rip everything into pieces and let it grow again, and then they would grow to patches that have a certain size, and then they close up, which means you get a reasonably monodisperse solution of vesicles at the end, because there's a critical size where these things flop around. Well, you can do the same thing another way around. Something like a spherical patch and a boundary can also be constructed like this. You can have a membrane and a hole in there. In which case, let's say there's a frame tension pulling on this thing and there's a hole. What happens? Well, in the case of constant tension, this is basically you say, well, what's the energy of something like this? Well, over an area of pi r squared, there's no membrane, so I don't have a surface tension. Minus pi r squared times sigma, but I have to pay 2 pi r times the line tangent gamma, and this gives rise to a very typical nucleation scenario. As a function of r, the energy first goes up, and then it goes down. So if the tension is big enough, you cross the barrier, and the pore opens, and once it's open and it's beyond critical pore size, the system just basically falls into pieces. Or you can do the same thing also, not a constant tension, but a constant area, in which case you say, okay, this is a membrane that we're pulling. There's an area elastic modulus for this, which means the area is 1/2 times the modulus times the area the membrane has minus the area it would like to have under zero tension squared divided by zero. So, but now I'm additionally have to subtract the area for the pore, but I have to pay line tangent. If I do this, I can again optimize for r and again a certain scenario for pore opening. This scenario, constant area, is particularly easy to do in simulation. We have done here a bunch of simulations for our models. The horizontal axis is basically the area that we gave to our bilayer, projected area. The vertical axis is the tension. So there's one particular area where the membrane is basically happy, it's tensionless. And if we start to pull, put any strain on the system, the stress goes up. In fact, it goes up almost always linearly, up to a point where something finally happens, suddenly there's a stress breakdown and we're suddenly down here. But what happens here is that a pore falls. Open the pore and suddenly that relieves stress. in the opposite direction, notice that this curve is not symmetric. So if I push, it would not go the other way around. But if you push very soon, the bilayer will buckle. So now you're not fighting against the compression modulus, which is very high, but just against the bending modulus, which is low. So pretty soon you end up with a very small negative tension pressure. In fact, so what did I say? A pore opening here and buckling here. But for pore opening, I just presented you with this very simple theory that says, okay, area expansivity minus pi r squared and 2 pi r. I can take this theory and try to fit it to these data from simulations, and it fits frighteningly well. So we here have our linear extension regime, the pore opening, and then even the entire shape of this curve is predicted correctly by this very, very simple theory. I mean, the theory does have three fitting parameters, which is what's the zero tension area, which is that point, what's the compressibility, which is that slope, and what's the rupture tension, which is where this breaks down. But how far it breaks down and how it's going to go on here is beyond your control. That has to come out right, and it does come out right. And since you have a theory you can fit, you can extract certain numbers out of this. For instance, what is the critical tension when this thing ruptures? Turns out if you translate this back into real units, 6 millinewtons per meter. Or how do I do real units? I know what the thermal energy is in real units, and I know what length is in real units because I know what the real thickness of a bilayer is, so I can translate these things back. The line tension turns out to be about 3 kT per nanometer. These values are not spectacularly good, but they're clearly the correct order of magnitude. What's also nice is that the critical strain at which it ruptures, in this case is on the order of 8%. What we heard this morning is about 3%. The number depends a bit on how big the system is, because if you use bigger systems, the critical strain becomes lower. That's also something the theory predicts. But it's in any way clearly better than the typical results you see from DPD simulations, in which case the critical strain is something like 100%. So you can stretch these membranes by a factor of 2, and then they make a hole, which is a bit very big. Well, let's now go for something more biology, like a nice application of all this, where I think this sort of level of modeling makes a lot of sense. Lipid sorting. And similar things can be said also to protein sorting. There's one curious thing inside cells. So there are all these different cell membranes. There's plasma membrane, there's the Golgi, there are endosomes, there are transport vesicles going back and forth between all these things all the time. And yet we all know that the lipid compositions of each and every one of these membranes is different. Now how come that all this lipid trafficking is not messing up this lipid composition gradient within an hour or minutes? That's basically the problem of lipid sorting, how do these things remain their composition, and it's basically not really fully understood. There are various hypotheses. An easy way of saying it is that proteins are responsible for that, but that doesn't say why they do. One hypothesis says that evidently these things, for instance the transport vesicles, differ markedly in the curvature they have compared, for instance, to the plasma membrane. So one idea was that lipids notice the state of curvature in which they are, preferentially therefore go into, let's say, forming buds, don't go into forming buds, and therefore these vesicles form at a selective lipid composition, and that's actually so that all this vesicle trafficking creates these gradients rather than obliterates them. But that relies on the idea is that these lipids can sense the curvature they live in. Is that really true? Or to what, it's probably going to be true, but to what extent is it? And that's something that can be rather easily tested. So we take our membranes, we take two, let's say a 50-50 mixture of lipids, one head is a bit bigger and one head is a bit smaller, to account for the fact that the one probably would like to be in a membrane which bends in this direction, and this one probably in a membrane which bends the other direction. If you put these things in the membranes, the naive guess would be that the orange guy would probably rather like to be on the outside, and the blue guy would probably rather like to be on the inside. It seems to be like this because there's so much orange on the outside, but that's a deception because the orange guys are bigger, so we need to do correct counting. Well, but these simulations can be done, we have done them, and basically what you do, if you look at a cross-section of this, you count how much of the orange stuff on the outside and the inside, and then you need some theory to analyze that. The simplest theory tells you the energy per lipid to be in any given bilayer bending state, this is just 1/2 times any given modulus, times the difference between the curvature of the bilayer and some characteristic preferred curvature for the lipid squared. And there's also entropy, for that you just take an ideal gas. It just behaves like ideal gas. optimizing the lipid distribution under these things, under material conservation and everything like that, gives you the prediction that if you look at the density of the big-headed lipids in the outer monolayer versus the density of big-headed lipids in the inner monolayer, take the log of that, that should be proportional to the curvature of your bilayer, with prefactors which depend on the coupling strength, the lipid curvature, and it's inverse to k to the thermal energy. Because if you heat up the system, all these differences will be obliterated by thermal energy. So the prediction is, do these for different vesicle sizes, and plot this log of that ratio against the curvature. And that's what we've done, and it fits marvelously. Initially, when I first came up with this theory, I thought it's going to be too simple, and how are we going to extend on that? But it turns out that's all we need. So the two different curves shown here are for two different strengths of this lipid asymmetry. So this has a stronger asymmetry than that one, and it fits in here, so we can basically extract all that. Well, now let's take numbers out of that. There are many ways in which I could affect preferred curvature. I could do something with tail attraction. So it's one way of doing it, which Bob involves the simplest to do.
So you have a linear, what's your curve for the preferred gradient of curvature?
Oh, we're not working that out. We're not trying to make the relation between this KL and the Hamiltonian in any way quantitative. That was not the intent. But we do know at which head radius does this thing totally no longer prefer to be in the membrane. Know that at some point, like to form cylindrical micelle, and that tells us about that much you can go with lipid head size before the stuff, before you can't play around with it anymore.
The expression that you just write,
can come back
KL.
Yeah, but well, that goes in the theory. We are not able to determine K. We are able by fitting to determine the product of the modulus and the lipid curvature, but we can't get them separate. They always occur in this combination. Anyway, so let's put numbers in there. Let's say this dot, for instance, corresponds to this vesicle. Here, the log, the ratio is about 0.45, which means phi out of phi in is 0.6. Now, phi out and phi in is like 1/2 plus a bit more on the outside, and phi in is 1/2 minus a bit more, minus a bit less on the inside. That tells you that this delta phi is about 11%. Not very much, but something. But in general, if you do this for any general point here, it turns out that this delta phi, so you can work it out exactly using this relation again, scales inversely with the radius. So for radius going to infinity flat membranes, there would be no difference, of course, anymore. But that means if you go ahead and take a vesicle of 50 nanometers, somewhere around here, which is about the size that these transport vesicles would have in real life, this difference goes down to something like 3%. And if you go to the articles that tell you about the efficiency of lipid sorting, we're not talking about 3% sorting, we're talking about 90 or 95% sorting. So that's clear. So this clearly is not enough. Something's missing here, okay? One of the things that could be missing is the fact that we neglected lateral interactions in the sense that it doesn't have to be an ideal gas. There can be reasons why, for instance, light lipids would like to phase separate from each other, in which case there would be a cooperative thing helping you to establish this thing. But this is, you have to try. We haven't done this yet. We haven't done anything yet. It's certainly worth trying out what that would do. One suggestion, though, that has been made by molecular biologists in an article that we have already seen up on the board several times in this workshop, is that they say, well, we do have quite a lot of curvature in this bulging region of the vesicle, but we have an even bigger curvature maybe around here in the neck region. This is sort of a weird suggestion. The reason why you see it's weird, because if you start to see what the labels they wrote to their vesicle, to me this gives clearly the intention that they have no idea about curvature on surfaces. But they thought there's going to be more curvature here than there, so maybe the sorting actually occurs in the neck region. I have to look more closely to the neck. So let's look more closely now. So we created a neck. Right? The way we created a neck is that we just gave the membrane a colloid to eat, which was maybe 80% covered, and the rest was not. So the membrane sticky, so the membrane would wrap around this thing about that much, and then it wouldn't wrap further because the rest was not sticky anymore. So we get this kind of deformation around here. I took it out so they can see something. We put this kind of deformation, and then we can again count everywhere here, where are the big guys, where are the small guys. Out here you can just do a radial average, and that gave you the number that I showed you before, but in the neck region it's a bit hard to quantify this. So what we basically did is we looked at density maps. Maybe I should say the following thing. What this thing is missing is the fact that even though this radius of curvature is much smaller than the overall radius of curvature here, there's a second radius of curvature and it has the opposite sign. So the mean curvature, which is the sum of these two, including the sign difference, is actually very small here. And then you start to think, since I was coupling to the mean curvature in the model, to lowest order, that's all I can couple to, what comes from that? Well, what comes from that, if you look at the density map, it's a bit hard to see what it means. It's the density of big-headed guys. And you see that in this region here, there's this black accumulation basically in the outer monolayer, as you expected. There's a preferential accumulation of big-headed lipids on the outer side. But up here in the neck region, this difference obliterates, it vanishes. There's no preference for the big guys to be either here or either there, which is due to the fact that, as I mentioned, the mean curvature is zero, and the model predicts that. You say, well, I have to go to bigger lipid curvatures and make all the effects stronger, but at some point, the simulations told you if you make the lipid too strongly asymmetric, it's not going to prefer the bilayer shape at all. It's going to fall apart and make micelles. So, okay, the last few minutes, one final topic. We heard about mediated interactions from general on the basis of a healthy Hamiltonian. What we would like to do is might do the same thing in the simulation, because we can now reach length scales for which something like this is appropriate. So here you can see a membrane. This particular one has a bending stiffness of about 30 kT. There's a colloid sitting here being partially engulfed by the membrane. There's another colloid here you can see because it's on the other side. To make it better visible, let's just look at the cross-section of this thing. So there's a colloid sitting here. 50% of it is sticky. So the membrane wraps around it. There's a colloid here on the other side. So these things are called, by the way, Janus colloids, and they're not as weird as they initially think. So experimentalists build these things and put it on membranes and do other things with it and so on. So we just build them in our computer. We apply zero lateral tension. We have these colloids here, and we'd like to measure forces. To measure forces, we can't let them just go there, because if there are forces, they will come together or pull apart, and then we don't know what the force is a function of distance. So we basically do the same thing that also experimentalists would do in a real experiment. They turn on laser tweezers to hold them where they are. Now, an experimentalist needs something like a $100,000 setup to build a laser tweezer. We need only like three lines of codes, and that we have our colloids fixed. And the forces we need to hold them where they are, the forces the tweezers exert on these particles, those are the mediated forces by the membrane, and we can now measure them. So these are very preliminary results for these things. Distance, these four points are what we've done so far, other forces. Now basically everything on this plot is weird. What you expect,
you're sort of fixing one.
We're fixing
distance.
The distance, we're fixing
sort of
the horizontal distance, but
horizontal
not that
distance,
one, only the horizontal. If they want to go like this, they're free to do that.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Everything about this plot is weird. If you do the only theory that people can do by paper and pencil, which is linear theory, linear half theory, what you expect is a weak long range repulsion. What we get is a strong short range attraction. So evidently there are other things going on here. For instance, the fact that the membrane here acts like a double-sided tape that glues these things together, which is clearly not present in the Helfrich model. We're working now on getting the other things straight and right. But these are the things we're trying now. So you remember also that there are relations between the geometry of this membrane and the forces, as Gemma has told you. The question is, can we see these things here? What are the fluctuations doing? These are not ground state membranes. They fluctuate. Are they causing the forces? And if they are, can we actually identify them? All these forces are going to be very weak, so it's a challenge to get them. So you need to run the system for a long time to get statistics. And that's why only these kind of coarse grain models, where you have a chance to run it long enough and get long length scales, will have a chance to do these things. One more movie at the end. So here we have four colloids in the membrane. Mind you that it's not enough to understand two colloids, because this is a nonlinear theory. So there are multi-body terms, multi-body interactions. So what do they do? So here we have four colloids in the membrane plus periodic boundary conditions. So that corresponds something like to a dense phase of colloids. Half of them are on the upper side and have them on the lower side of the membrane. Let's just see what something like this might do. So they wobble around the membrane.
Yeah, the tweezers on?
What?
Are the tweezers on?
The tweezers are not on here.
Okay.
You see these things face separate off, the membrane stretches quite a bit in this direction, which means it comes together in that direction, it gets corrugated. And in this case, for instance, the one on the same side came together and attracted. I mean, there's no attraction because the membrane just pulled them together. These things are also together, but they're together under the perfect boundary condition, which you can't see. You can see all this a bit better if you rotate the system a bit. So you see these two came together, these came together, and all this, of course, there's no statistics. I mean, that's just a single run, so we do this more carefully, repeat, and see if you don't take four, but if you take 4x4 and see whether you still get these kind of herringbone structure for repeating. Well, so that was all. I had showed you a simple solvent-free coarse grains lipid model. You're going to hear about another one on Wednesday and another one on Thursday. The physics is correct on these length scales. The values are tunable. And biological questions that we try to show you are accessible, such as budding, coarsening, sorting. And there are many more such questions on this level, protein-mediated interactions, and all these things that you can study here. And that's something for the future, and maybe any one of you feels enticed to try any of that. And that was, those are the people who actually did all the research. This is Ira, with whom I developed the model. This guy did the stretching of the cylinders. Gregoria does mediated interactions with proteins. These interactions are done by Ben. Martin is doing this kind of stuff. Dawood is doing the AFM indenting. People I talk, people who gave the money, people who do the programming. And I do nothing. I just give the talks. Thank you.